So we'll see what sort of questions we have tonight. I've seen both monastics and lay people start getting ill after they become serious with practice. Can you relate this to your talk today? Whether such illness is karmic, etc. I think we get ill all the time. You know, in the sense that, you know, sometimes you see people getting better and come practice and you know, their health gets really good. I don't think it's I don't see a consistent enough pattern. I mean, I've been around pretty long. The reality is, say, like for me, you get sick when you go to live in Thailand and live in the forest, and your body's not used to being in tropical conditions, and inevitably you get sick. Or you go and live in forests, and I mean, you can't say, "Wow, some horrible karmic obstacle because I went and lived in a forest and got malaria." I mean, you make choices, and you have to sort of accept those choices, and yeah, part of especially for myself. Living in, and for many of the early students of Ajahn Chah, even by Thai standards, going to live in forest monasteries in the northeast of Thailand was considered kind of backwoods and rustic. And then access to care was not so so available. Although living in America is not much better. That was actually part of when Ajahn Amaro and I were discussing about me coming to. Going to join with the kind of project of beginning a Bhayagiri. I had a history of various illnesses and injuries and hospital stays, doctors, and that was one of the things Ajahn Amaro made me make a strong aditana or determination that I wouldn't get sick coming to America because we couldn't afford to look after me. So, and it's worked pretty well. Okay, could you clarify the difference between perception, sanya, mental formation, sankhara, and consciousness, vijnana? So perception is the function of memory. Sanya, the root of sanya is in memory, and that's also it has when you think of the word that we translate as mindfulness, it has the same root sat, so that. Recollection is the stronger meaning for sati. So perception, as sanya, is a function of memory, but then also part of that aspect of sanya is then also being able to label and have a label for what we perceive. So that the function of perception is to And it works with memory as well. So you see something that you go outside and there's this green fluffy stuff up and going up into the air, and you say, "Oh, and that's like tree." And so you immediately you see that, and tree is the kind of perception that comes. You've got a name for it or a grouping to put it under. So that then it works with memory, giving being able to sort things in terms of you know, kind of categories. Mental formations is the characteristic of mental formations is volition or intention, and that is the whole range of thoughts and emotions, and directing, say, like directing of attention, so that mindfulness is a sankhara, wisdom is a sankhara, anger and ill will are sankharas, loving kindness is a sankhara, so that these are the mental formations of either thought or mood or emotion that one directs one's attention to with a volitional activity. It's a volitional formation. And then consciousness is the conscious awareness of the sense bases. So they're being conscious of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and mental objects, things in the mind. Can you talk about neither painful nor pleasant feelings and the benefits of being with this boringness? Well, sometimes, in reality, most of what we experience is kind of neither painful nor pleasant. It's kind of, so it's not... if it's boring, that's actually an unpleasant sensation. That's kind of a unpleasant sensation, painful sensation actually. Neither painful nor pleasant is the neutral aspect of the feeling tone of experience, and. Things are usually, and this is fairly quick that we, we experience something, and there's a feeling tone to it. We see or taste or touch or think or feel something in our emotion, on emotional sense, and there's a feeling tone to that experience, and it could be either painful or it could be either pleasant or it could be neither painful nor pleasant. And but certainly the willingness to be with the neither painful nor pleasant, which, as I was saying, probably comprises the majority of our experience, really, when we're willing to be present with that, then there's an alertness and awareness that can arise. There's a discourse, I think it's in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's the questions of that are directed to the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina. And she talks about the painful, say, the underlying tendency associated with painful feeling is aversion. The underlying tendency to pleasant feeling tends to be desire. And the underlying tendency to neither painful nor pleasant tends to be ignorance. And so that there's so that by bringing a clarity of attention, then we don't just follow an underlying tendency, an underlying habit, and then we can be able to experience the neutral aspects of existence without drifting into unawareness or delusion. Could you please talk about different places where the chain of dependent origination can be broken? For example, does contact always result in Vedana? And then if the intention to be conscious is to let go of, is that breaking the chain at, say, that ignorance conditioning, sankhara conditioning, vijnana? Contact always results in Vedana. That's a natural part of the process of having, because contact is, say, sense contact, and whatever contact we have will always result in something that's either pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant. So that that's a given. Of course, the undermining of ignorance is a breaking the chain at the very beginning. There's also an opportunity to breaking the chain at with Vedana's condition, and there's the arising of tanha, of desire, and then one can relinquish or let go of tanha, or one can relinquish and let go of, with tanha as condition, there's the arising of attachment. One can also let go of attachment. So those are opportunities that we have. It's also in that whole part of desire, attachment, becoming. Those are all places where one can put a wedge in that chain of dependent origination. The letting go, the relinquishing is a kind of a de facto opportunity to step out of that chain of the those links of cause and the effect that arises from that. Okay, thank you for the wonderful Dhamma talk on the five reflections. Could you please speak about compassion in caregiving for themselves and for others? And part of caregiving, of looking after those who are ill, then that a part of the compassion is looking after oneself. There's things that what the Buddha talks about of the, like, somebody who is a good patient is somebody who follows the doctor's advice, eats the right foods, and takes their medicines, so that looking after oneself with care and being attentive to the caregivers, and then for the one who is caring for the sick, it's sort of knowing the right medicines, knowing the right foods, knowing how to
knowing how to encourage them and rouse them.
Knowing how to encourage and rouse them with Dhamma, so that these so looking after oneself, say, as a caregiver, it is important to knowing how to exercise that quality of compassion in looking after oneself, because it's easy to get burnt out. It's easy to, and depending on the kind of illness that somebody's having, knowing how to rest, in the sense also in terms of like compassion and looking after those who are ill, because sometimes the person who is ill might be very tired and sleeping a lot, but then the caregiver is kind of always alert and worried and concerned, and it's very easy to get tired, and then if one gets really tired, it's difficult to be attentive, and then the experience of the caregiving can be quite a draining, and so that one has to know how to look after oneself with compassion. So learn, and some of it is also learning how to ask other people to help. I mean, sometimes we don't think of that, or we're afraid, or we're fearful in some way, and so that knowing how to call on others to give support, because when one's caring for the sick, yeah, oftentimes one just doesn't rest well, and learning how to conserve one's energy is really really important. So there's the kind of skills of knowing medicine, knowing the skills of looking after other people, but then also knowing the skills of looking after oneself and caring for oneself, as well as caring for the person who is ill. Okay, reflecting on your talk earlier about letting go. I'm currently at a point in my life with many important decisions to make. When trying to watch my breath, a voice in my mind keeps saying, "That's too important to let go," as if I'm neglecting the responsibility. Wondering if you can speak about maintaining a practice during retreat and also in so-called, quote-unquote, normal life under these circumstances. Well, actually, so much of the... if one has a really important decision, one of the most important things is to be able to settle the mind before making that decision, rather than if the mind is always just chewing it over all the time. It's just, that's actually a really good way of reflecting on it, because it's like one chews and chews and chews on this particular difficulty, and it looks pretty awful, actually. It's like a bit of chewed up food it's really unappealing, and we do that with our decisions that we make, and it just starts to have this not very distinct qualities to it. So it's important to be able to come at it with a clear mind. If it's an important decision, then the watching of the breath and a letting go of the compulsion and fear and worry and desire around it is a way of actually clarifying the particular circumstance. And because we tend not to make it more clear, the more we think about something doesn't necessarily make it more clear. The circumstance is pretty much the same. The decision is pretty much the same. It's just that we've thought ourselves into usually a state of frenzy or confusion oftentimes. And then it's difficult to make a clear decision. So that actually setting things down, when I say letting go, it doesn't mean abdicating any kind of responsibility and wisdom. It's learning how to shed the compulsions and the obsessions that oftentimes, especially when something's important or so-called important, those kind of obsessions and worries and concerns and attachments to how one wants or doesn't want something to be will tend to impinge on the decision-making process. So learning how to put things down, let go, to the degree that one can then approach it with some clarity and stillness is much more fruitful. Okay, during meditation, when thoughts come and went to engage me, I can see the something or other some of the time. Some thoughts have the power to take me into the storyline, and I don't even know why. Don't even know when. Is there a point, a sign, or a warning that can be seen before I get lost? It's really painful to live in virtual reality that never delivers the promise. Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the. Different people will have different methods or ways of doing that, because of course. The nature of thought is compelling, and it does create these seeming realities. For myself, what I found helpful for me is actually using the body as a base. So that when I tune into the body and have the body as an anchor, when thoughts come up, then when you're using using the body as a mirror, one can start to recognize. Because thoughts always, they're always, they have a seeming reality to them and they have a logic. But tuning into the body is then I can start to feel where it's taking me. Different thoughts will take one to agitation or to a desire base, and one can start to feel the pull or the sinking feeling or the agitation or the sort of almost like a cloud coming in. So then it's more like paying attention to the tone that arises out of the thoughts. So that's what I find is for myself is more trustworthy, because Yeah, I mean, there is. It's almost like, you know, like there's always an, like in, when you're dreaming, there's an internal logic to the dream that when you're dreaming, it all makes sense. Well, it has, thoughts have the same kind of logic somehow. And you know, one keeps following the different thoughts, and then you, at some point in time, you kind of, how the heck did I get here? That's what I find with the, I can tune in a bit quicker using the body, because I can get a sense of the feeling tone of where it's taking me. And, you know, I think everybody has to experiment and work with different ways and see what actually helps one for oneself. What comes to mind is Ajahn Chah, you know, in relationship to thoughts, something that Ajahn Chah once said. He said, you know what the quickest way to enlightenment is? And of course, everybody wants to know. And he said, just look at the thoughts and just point your finger and say, liar. Okay, dear Ajahn Vasano, thank you for all the guidance and encouragement. Past months have been very busy and stressful for me. Now, as I begin to let my mind settle, I'm noticing lots of patterns of tension in my heart, diaphragm, belly, etc. These tensions sometimes make the breath an unpleasant object to stay with. Any advice? I think one of the things with, especially in relationship to the breath, one is trying to stay with the breath, oftentimes makes an unpleasant feeling around it. And it's more like, especially when there's tension in the body, then one can use just the rhythm of the breath in more of like a global way of the experience, and then letting the breath be something that, you know, is present, but you're not really trying to focus attention on it that much. And it's more like letting that wash through the body in order to relax and dissolve tensions that are there. Other ways are just by using the body going from the top of the head and just consciously just relaxing, just using, not trying to pay attention to the breath, not trying to focus attention on anything in particular as a single point of focus, but starting from the top of the head, and just visualizing the body relaxing, softening, going through the head, through the face, just paying attention to softening and relaxing, going through the shoulders, the back, the chest area, the abdomen, the lower back, the buttocks, the legs, the calves, the feet. It's almost like letting that perception of the body soften and relax. One can also almost like bring an image of, or a sensation, imagining a sensation of warmth, so that one is letting, because there's the, just with warmth there tends to be certain softening, kind of cozy kind of feeling, just letting that soften the body, and using, going up and down through the body, so that those kinds of tensions are able to be released. One can use a is using rather than a say like a body based meditation, using the meditations on loving kindness, bringing up those, and of course traditionally, and the first person that one directs loving kindness towards is oneself. It's like when we do the chant, "May I abide in well-being." May I, and to really take that in, and directing loving kindness toward oneself, bringing up that emotion of kindness, of caring, and letting that come through the heart, through the body, using those phrases to let that attention sustain itself, and a base of well-being, allowing that to establish itself. In letting go of thoughts that habitually arise from negative self-criticism or from past trauma defenses, how do we ask these powerful mental states to not overwhelm our mindfulness? Actually, that's ties in with it, what I just said really using a conscious awareness in relaxing and settling, softening, and then also that base of loving kindness and compassion, really making that conscious that fundamental well-wishing and kindness toward oneself. Could you clarify whether having more than one meditation object is a help or a hindrance? For example, breath, walking, walking, breath. Is this not directed, evaluative? The alternative is sort of non-directive it's necessary to develop the skills of being able to direct attention and then to actually assess what's the results of the attention that I'm relying on, rather than letting the mind drift according to either its habits or whichever mood grabs it at any particular time. Having more than one meditation object, is it a help or is it a hindrance? This depends on our own and our own skill and our own ability to apply our attention to the to the meditation object. I find for myself that it's helpful to have certainly more than one meditation object, having some options for the mind to be able to sustain interest and to look at things from different angles and directions in order to see things more clearly. It's also, as a meditator, I think it's important to develop skill in applying our attention in meditation in different ways. There's a if one were a homeowner and you've got something that needs to be fixed at your house, and a carpenter shows up, and all he's got is one hammer. He might get it done, might get the job done, but I'd have a doubt about it. So that in the same way, I mean, the job we have to do is to understand and to untangle the different ways that we create suffering. And I find it's helpful to have a few different tools to be able to do that and to apply it. And also, I don't know about anybody else's mind, but my mind, if I keep plugging away with one technique, one method, every single sitting, every day, every week, every month, I get bored. And so to have some different ways of freshening the meditation, freshening the way that looking at things, so that able to see things more clearly, and that. I mean, there is a danger in the sense of at the first little obstacle, then the problem. Okay, the problem is I don't have the right meditation object, so I should get another one. But and it is a problem in the sense if we don't have the patience to stick with a particular practice long enough, then we oftentimes don't see the result. But I think there is a need and a for developing skills of how do we develop a because a continuity of, and I've mentioned it, developing a continuity of attention and awareness isn't just the continuity of holding one meditation object. It's the continuity of having a clear and bright mind, a clear and bright heart. That's what you want. What you're trying to tap into the underlying quality of clarity and brightness that the heart is capable of. And so the different ways that we can access that are important to develop skill with. And that's where our continuity is. Thank you for your uplifting and encouraging talks. My husband died 6 months ago. Could you give suggestions for how to contemplate anicca and anatta in the context of his life, illness, and death? I'm aware of aversion to the pain of losing him. I do want to learn from all this. I think one of the things that's important is to... There's a naturalness to grief, and that the grief of losing a spouse is you can't just say that wave the magic wand of Dhamma over it and then it's going to go away. There needs to be a recognition of its naturalness, but then also how it comes in waves, and seeing the impermanence of the feelings that arise, and then recognizing the attachments that we have and the way that memories work, and seeing, oh, this is all Dhamma displaying itself. And I think it's also helpful to be, one contemplates impermanence and the uncertainty of life, but then it's also the other side of that coin is also contemplations and cultivations of gratitude, in the sense of the gratitude of having shared a good life with someone, opportunities for dedications of merit and blessings, really bringing up what it's wholesome and positive, and dedicating the goodness that arises in the heart to someone who's passed away, particularly someone who's very close to us, so that these are, and there is aversion to the pain of losing one, but that's it, recognizing, does that, in terms of a coping tendency, you think, that's not so helpful, but it's in the sense that, how can I take that and transform that into, and I think that's one of the things that in terms of the a Dhamma practice, giving ourselves the opportunity to bring in the things that we are experiencing, and even if it's something negative, and then allowing it to transform one through softening towards it, being accepting of something like that, the acceptance of that aversion to the pain of loss. And because because usually what we do is we want to push that away. We don't want to experience that. And that tends to perpetuate the feeling. But then and this applies across the board in so many of the things that that are difficult for us. But to be able to bring it in and have the confidence within oneself that, I can work with this. This can be transformed. This can be dealt with skillfully. And it has the seeds of the other side of the coin, that aversion to the pain of loss is then also a connection with compassion, and it's important to give oneself that opportunity to allow that to shift. So those are off the top of my head, a few ways of looking at that. Is there a distinction between dispassion and equanimity? I think in terms of Yeah, sometimes yes, sometimes no. In the sense that it's probably helpful to have different terms and for the way that we perceive something, so that, and just using the English language, so that dispassion is a settling of the passion, a settling of pull, the draw toward something. So there's a cooling and a settling. And equanimity is more like an evenness and being equable with any experience that we have. So that, I mean, in some ways it's, you know, it's not much of a distinction, but in other ways, when we reflect on it, it's slightly, there is a distinction. There's a slight difference in the way it's held and how it's felt. Okay, thank you for a wonderful teaching. Question: how to identify and deal with pancha upadana in daily life? So, I think in reference to the morning chanting that we do, pancha upadana kanda dukkha, so the five focuses of the grasping mind. Upadana is attachment or clinging. Pancha is five, so that the upadana or clinging that is focusing on the five aggregates of being: form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. So that to, and I think that's probably the most helpful thing to be, is to recognize, one, when just what the focus of attachment and clinging is, in the sense of, okay, that's, there's clinging toward body or form, whether it's one's own or others, or physical form in some way, feeling, the different, the painful, pleasant, neutral feeling, perception, memory, mental formations, consciousness, so recognizing the objects of clinging, objects of attachment. But then also turning it back and paying attention to the internal experience of attachment, clinging, identification, that movement of mind in the heart, and recognizing how it pulls in different ways. And of course the pull immediately, one loses one's base of stability. There's that pull, there's an attachment, identification with something, and then one is shaken. One has an imbalance, and trying to relate to ourselves and the world around us with a foundation of imbalance is then that it's always going to result in suffering in some way. So then that's just recognizing, okay, how do I return to a place of balance? How do I find an anchor of stability internally? And of course, that's the... Okay, the one is recognizing, okay, this is attachment, but then it's recognizing the result, coming back to and that's what you say, is returning to awareness, returning to the quality of knowing, being present. Okay, Ajahn, it seems like The first couple of days, all hindrances attack to a point where I open my eyes this morning, meditation, and thought, how did I get here? What am I doing here? There must have been some aspiration. It almost felt disconnected, but also as if I've woken up. Can you please comment? I think that's quite true in that sense of... Because it's so important to be able to recollect that aspiration especially when one swept up in a multiple hindrance attack, it's actually helpful to actually open the eyes, because inside it's swirling around. And then that recollection of aspiration is really important. You wouldn't have got your butt here and onto the cushion without an aspiration. And that's a really positive aspiration. It's a very noble aspiration to come and be on a retreat for 10 days. There's a lot of other things you could have been doing, but having consciously chosen to come to a retreat and be in a contained environment and of simplicity and focus. And that's it's a really noble aspiration. It's really important to recollect that, because the mind cranks out all of the things that distraction but it in the end the yeah it's sort of like there's a longing and a hunger for peace and meaning, so that to be able to facilitate and support that aspiration as much as possible. And it's an act of real kindness to oneself, and that really does benefit oneself and benefits others. And so we have to remind ourselves of that sometimes. Okay, so I have an empty basket. We can have a bit of a break and come back for the evening chanting.